Tell me about the hut at Admiralty Bay. This was just like Signy, wasn't it, the hut?
It was identical to Signy. I knew that Harold...
Were you building it from scratch?
Yes.
Right.
Sorry. Absolutely from scratch. Even carrying the stuff ashore, all the parts and the cement fondue and the aggregates and everything, every damn thing. Okay. Now, I have instinctively got this feeling that the foundation should support the hut, especially down there, quite high off the ground, and so that you can get circulation of air underneath the hut, and you know it'll keep it going for quite a long while because it's only timber and it's going to decay. Ron and I fell out over this aspect because he said, no, you're wasting cement. Put it in as low as you can get it, and down the end where the diesel engine was, you're going to have about a 4-inch slab of concrete. And I said, you know, I don't like this idea of cutting corners. And I said, I know Harold didn't like it either. He said, well, I'm in charge. Do it my way, you see. So I said, right, you're in charge. I'll do it your way. I said, but don't forget that I don't like it. You know, I don't like skimping things. So anyway, we put the foundation in. We got the flooring done and the everything, you know, the hut, the framework stood on the floor. And, you know, it was going along quite well. We did have a storm, and it did fill up with snow, which was unfortunate because it caught us just at the wrong time where the windows were there without being glazed. And the door wasn't on, and so it could blow right through and deposit snow. And it's not just a bit of snow, it's one whole damn lot. And, of course, you've got to find a window to throw it out, you know, or find a hole or wheelbarrow or whatever else. And that's to me, that's just wasted energy, wasted effort, because you've done this job and now you've got to clear out. And if you're not careful, a wind will blow again before you've got the glass in and it'll do it again. I don't think we'd got such a thing as sheets of polythene by then, clear polythene. Otherwise, we could have probably prevented many of these things. But Ray Cooper and I worked together. Of course, Ray was Harold's friend from the Navy. They knew each other. And because I'd worked with Harold, I spoke to Ray Cooper. Ray Cooper's a very shy, quiet, but tough guy. And he just worked his way through. I found him good companion. Not entertaining like Harold, but a different sort. He wouldn't volunteer information and stories. Mm. But it was his background, and you know, because he'd had a very unpleasant background back, you know, his childhood. He joined the Navy, and his life began, I think, from once he was in the Navy. I lost contact. Oh, no, I didn't. That's strange, isn't it? When I left Bass, I went to live in Norfolk and teach at the Norwich City College. And one day, a fellow came and rang the bell on the door and said, hello, do you recognise me? And I said, I've got half of a memory of you. Who are you? And he said, Ray Cooper. I said, Ray Cooper, good God. He said, yeah, I've lost the sight of one eye. But he went to Canada from Bass and he married a local girl and was trapping fur-bearing creatures, living with some strange Indians. And he got scurvy and that cost him a few stones in weight and the loss of one eye. But I think he's dead now.
We were back at Admiralty building the hut, weren't we? And building it with reservations about... Were your reservations eventually proved right?
They closed it the following year, I think.
Because it wasn't fit, or...?
No, they decided... was it a year or two later? They closed Admiralty Bay because it was no longer required... surplus to requirements, became a refuge.
Right.
So it wouldn't have mattered, really. Right. But I think I must be a bit of a Puritan in a way, or perfectionist, because, you know, I visualise the huts being lifted out the ground and kept up relatively high so that you can get circulation of air underneath as well, because it's timber, for heaven's sake. You need to ventilate timber, keep it dry. But not so with Ron. Ron had different ideas to me.
You and... You left Finns at this point, didn't you?
Yes.
Why?
Yeah. Well, you can't just keep on doing year after year, living on the bases.
They wouldn't let you?
They would. They'd let you do 3 years. I didn't want to. I wanted to have a look at the Falklands in particular. So I went, I think at this stage, I went out to Pebble Island as a school teacher, is that right, according to my record?
I don't know.
You don't know? I think I did. It's not mentioned, no. Okay, I went to the Falklands and I thought I'll keep writing to Harold, because Harold was an interesting fella and he kept writing to me. And I did a spell in the Falklands, then went up to Montevideo. And when I was in Montevideo, I wrote to Harold and said, you know, if you want to contact me here, this is my address. And he did. He wrote back a postcard saying, I'm on the way back. I'm glad to, you know, contact you, because I was wondering if you'd be interested in, it's a big job. It's a new hut for Stonington and a hangar for the aircraft. And I said, oh, wow. Well, I'll come along if you're in charge, you see, because I said, you know, we can work together. Yes, you know we can work together. So he said, right, well, I'll sign the contract in London if you would come and join the ship either in Stanley or in Montevideo. So I think I joined the ship in Stanley, and we went down to... supposedly down to Margaret Bay, but the sea ice was too thick, and in spite of having ice breakers smashing the ice for us, it was the year that Pearson couldn't get into Stonington Island, because he was heading that way, wasn't he? Was that 61? Mm-hmm. Or something like that. And so we didn't get in, and that was a bit disappointing, and so we went back to Stanley with all the parts of the hut on the ship. And when we got into Stanley, Johnny Green came and met Harold and said, we've decided what to do. The hangar can go into store here on the Fenia, on this boat, on this ship, and the hut, or what was going to be the hut, we've decided to have it built in Stanley as the new Met office. And so would you be interested in staying and putting it up? And so that's what we did. We spent a year in Stanley and put it up.
How was that?
Well, I like it. I to me, the Falkland Islands is... it's a place where you appreciate what freedom's really like. Well, and the Antarctic, of course. But in the Falklands, nobody ever asks you what you're doing. You know, what in the hell do you think you're doing? They don't do that in the Falklands. If you want to go and do some fishing over there on a creek over on the south coast, nobody will ever stop you. There's total freedom. And even better than that, I had a motorcycle and Harold and I were going out to a place called Bluff Cove and to do a little bit of fishing or shooting, and we'd taken some equipment with us. And when we got over to Bluff Cove, the farmer, instead of saying, you know, you can't come on my land or anything like that, he said, go up to the kitchen and tell my wife you want a drink, you see. So I thought it would be coffee, you know. But he said, I'll be up in a minute, you see. And he got up there and says, where's the rum then? or with whatever you're drinking. And they actually welcome you. They like to see people. They like to come and have a chat with you. And they're not in the least hostile towards anybody else. Except the Argentine, of course.
So you did that at Stanley.
Yeah.
And then had you rejoined FIDS or BASS at that point? Or were you working as a freelancer?
Were still on BASS pay.
You were?
So, yeah, we just got our money as normal.
Right, OK. And then you went to 61, you went to the Argentine.
I went to the Argentine Islands, and Harold had made up his mind by then that his future wasn't in building, that he was going to have to think about, he's a lot older man than me. I think he's 9 years older than me, and he decided that eventually he'd have to come to England. He's going to need a profession. He'd need to stand on his feet and learn something. So he thought, birds, that's it. I'll join the conservancy or whatever else. So he spoke to Lance Tickell and said, what's the future hold for me if I want to join the conservancy? And Lance Tickell said, you can come with us to Bird Island. You could ring a few thousand wandering albatross, if you like. And stinkers and, these giant petrels and things. So Harold said, OK. And I think it was Harold and Charles Lefebvre, is that right? And Lance went to Bird Island and they had this programme of ringing birds. So we parted, really. We didn't part permanently because he was, it was the friendship went way beyond just working together and living together in the same place. Harold and I kept contact. He went with Lance, and so I went and saw Johnny Green and said, I understand there's an extension going on at Argentine Islands. And he said, yes, you're the very fella that we're looking for, actually. He said, because we can't get anybody else to do it. He said, we have advertised, but we haven't had any suitable candidates. So I said, I'll take it on then. And I didn't realise how big the job was. It was, the hut was 84 feet long, and the extension was another 80 coming down here. But, of course, it had differed from the old Bolton and Paul. The old Bolton and Paul hut was 4x2 timbers and tongue and groove boards on the outside and plywood or limpet board on the inside, or hardboard, and insulation between. And you did all this very laborious. The new hut, the new extension, was panels, 8 feet by 4 feet, already plywood on the outside, limpet board on the inside, and insulation between the studwork. The only problem was lifting an 8 foot by 4 foot into place and squeezing it up. So we did a little compromise. I said, where there's a will, there's a way. You don't forget, FIDS are supposed to be reliable people who can, get anything, set them a task and they'll do it, you see. Right, now this hut had these 8 foot by 4 foot panels, and sometimes they even had a window in already glazed, and you'd just lift it into place.
So it really was prefab?
It was a prefab. The piece you had to do was, the floor was 8 foot by 4 foot sheets as well, 8 foot by 4 foot panels, insulated, and they sat in the right place, and a sort of recess around the edge when you put a cover piece on. The roof was orthodox. Or did we have panels on the roof? I'm not sure that we didn't even have panels on the roof. And I had to spend one day felting the roof with bitumen. And that was it, really. All the other work, of course, was inside. The winter work was the inside bit. But I think I accomplished that almost on my own, almost. I did have help from people on the base, but they were reluctant because they had a full science programme.
Johnny Green, you mentioned him two or three times.
Yeah.
I mean, his name comes up occasionally.
Yes.
What sort of guy was he?
What sort of guy was he? He was... how can I best describe him? He was... he liked to be liked. He, when he was in Stanley, he would... he used to organise sort of rugby matches against the Navy when they came ashore. He was a nice fellow in many ways. I think he'd chosen the wrong career.
How do you mean?
With Bass. It didn't do him any good, Bass. It was too kind of easygoing, and he did have a tendency to drink a bit. Bit too much. I admired him in many ways, but yeah, he had a troubled life. He had a troubled personal life. I think he was divorced from his wife and he drank too much. I think he drowned in the end, didn't he? Did you know that? Oh, right. Now, Johnny Green, when he left Bass, he joined one of the Lindblad explorers, I think it was, something like that, who did a trip to the Antarctic and told the people aboard, that's a skua and that's a wandering albatross.
So he was
lecturing
on a tourist boat?
He was talking to the tourists about the Antarctic and his exploits there and the bird life there and so on. But apparently he was celebrating his birthday. And he did a Ron Napier. Mm. Say no more. Mm. He drowned.
Did you ever have any close calls?
Sometimes.
Such as?
With Brotherhood. Oh, yes,
we'll come
did.
To Brotherhood in the next session.
Right,
you
we did.
Was there any point in your time in the Antarctic you feared for your life?
No, not really. Not fearing for... Well, sometimes when you're in the field and the wind... Well, the first experience, when you're in the field and the wind's blowing 60, 70 knots and you're wondering whether you're going to lose your tent, what will happen. But after the first... two or three interludes of the first two or three, you come to accept it as it's always like this. He's not panicking. He's done it before, so I'll follow his lead, you know. But I did hear of an incident where Graham Dewar was in a tent. Graham Dewar was a geologist at Adelaide, and I think Brian Nixon was with him and somebody else. Alan Wright, I believe. Anyway, it was they had this incident, and I heard the details that the outdoor man had to go and secure the guy because he feared that the peg that was holding the guy on the tent was going to let go. So what he did, he took his ice axe and he put it through where the peg was, so that the ice axe would give an extra hold for the upwind guy, and got back in his sleeping bag and ping, the ice axe came through the tent. Of course, it's got a shiny handle and it'll pull out dead easy, and it's got sharp steel at both ends. It perforated the outer, but I don't think it perforated the inner, because you've got tent within a tent. It perforated the outer. And the wind got in, and so it blew the inner almost shut, and the outer went and flew off and left the inner with three men in there. So they had to reach up and get their trousers and everything on as quick as they could. And Graham Dewar, who had false teeth, put his teeth into a tin mug of water, which had frozen solid. And of course, when the wind blew, it blew this mug away, never got his teeth back. For the rest of the year, and he lost all his geological notes. that he'd accumulated in his time out in the field. And I was thinking, right, now, if that was me, if I'd been in the field, what would I do? Right, I'd have done like Nixon. A bit of a panic. I don't think I'd have put the ice axe upwind. I'd have probably put ice cubes, lumps of ice on the valance, because that's not going to blow away quite as easy as an ice axe, and try and, you know, weather the storm. Difficult. Difficult. We did have a 70-mile-an-hour wind at Fossil Bluff, and it actually blew grit and aggregate onto the tent. And I was thinking, cracky, you know, if we lose the tent, what do we actually lose? You know, will I lose my clothing? Will my anorak disappear? Now, Nixon, after this interlude, had to, because he'd lost a piece of his clothing, was it his windproof trousers or his trousers, had to, when they rescued them and he took a sledge up to bring them back to base, he had to run the whole way, otherwise he'd have frozen or got cold. So Brian Nixon had to, in his underpants or whatever, had to, you know, he was dressed perfectly well until you got down to the waist, and he had to just run and run and run to base without dying. And so, you know, the human spirit, if you have to do it, you can usually do it.
We'll take a break.
Okay.
May, Jim.